turned out that reactions which broke carbon-carbon bonds and they're generally the reactions we want to get rid of in our place in reforming, because we want to make aromatic hydrocarbons rather than crack down to little molecules. Turned out those reactions were strongly inhibited when I put copper with nickel, or gold with palladium, or essentially any group 1B metal with a group 8 metal. Turned out to be a general phenomenon. You make these group 8, group 1 alloys, and you find that cracking reaction is very selectively inhibited. So the group 8 metal becomes progressively more selective for the reaction you want, namely making an aromatic hydrocarbon out of it, or making an isomer. Certainly you don't want to make methane and ethane and that kind of stuff. So that was gold, and that happened almost from the first experiment. And it turned out to be general. So then I knew selectivity is a very important aspect of catalysis by alloy. That's a new scientific finding. That was a very important scientific development. That was very important. Then the other question that come along then, I knew if we found out anything that was going to be interesting about an alloy, we were going to have to face up to how could you make a practical alloy catalyst. Because the alloys that had been studied in the fundamental investigations had all been low surface area materials. You might have nickel-copper alloy films or nickel-copper powders. Matter of fact, some of my first experiments were with nickel-copper powders because I wanted to get good characterization of them, which you could do better with powders. You could get diffraction data, magnetic data, and so on. The surface area and those kinds of systems are often maybe two orders of magnitude too low for a commercial catalyst. For a commercial catalyst, you want the catalyst to be in a state where it's almost all surface. In other words, where you have a high ratio of surface to bulk in the material. So if I'm talking about a nickel crystallite, I'd like it to be maybe 10 angstroms in size, if I could achieve something like that. Because if it's 10 angstroms in size, almost all the atoms in that nickel crystal are on the surface. So they're accessible to the reactant. Well, we knew you could make those things for pure metals, because that's what made platinum reforming a success. That's the only way this expensive metal could be successful, is that the platinum crystallites, and the way you do that is you disperse the platinum on a high surface area oxide, like aluminum oxide. Aluminum oxide is a porous material, perhaps says 300 square meters per gram internal surface area in these pores, and you simply put chloroplatinic acid solution on that, you dry it, you reduce it, when you reduce it, you form very small platinum crystallites or clusters. And you could show from adsorption measurements that these clusters had to be something like 10 angstroms in size. Later on, you could see high-resolution electron microscopy pictures which showed that. Okay, so we knew how to do this for pure metals. Okay, but now if I'm going to make a nickel-copper alloy, I know how to do that in a powder, in a low surface area form. How am I going to make a highly dispersed nickel-copper alloy? Well, the first thing you pick, support it, just like we had the platinum on alumina. And now we'll put nickel and copper on the support. Okay, but these catalysts usually have a very small amount of metal relative to the support. In the case of a platinum catalyst, it's typically maybe 0.5% platinum and the other 99.5% alumina. And lots of catalysts are like that. Then if you're going to put nickel and copper on the catalyst in this small amount, how do I know they're going to alloy on the support? Suppose I put a solution of nickel and copper nitrates. Suppose I wet a support with this, dry it, and then reduce it. How do I know I don't have separate crystallites of nickel and crystallites of copper on that same support? Okay, well, I didn't have any physical tool to address that problem in those days, because the crystallites of these metals are going to be too small to get a diffraction pattern. what you would see if you try to get a diffraction pattern was essentially nothing. You'd just see a background. You wouldn't see any sharp lines. Okay, there were no physical tools to address this problem. Well, that's where the chemical probes come in. Remember what I told you about nickel and copper powder now, where I could make an alloy, and I knew I had an alloy because it wasn't supported. It was a low surface area material, so it's not going to be a practical catalyst. But I know how the reactions behave on this non-practical material. I know how much heptane goes to toluene, how much to crack products, how much to isomers, and so on. Now then I can put my, and I can characterize that nickel copper powder by diffraction. I can get diffraction patterns for that because these crystallites are real big. And I can measure the ferromagnetism, and I can see that as I add copper, it becomes less and less ferromagnetic, and so on. So now then, I put these nickel and copper on the support, and I can't characterize it by a physical probe, but I can pass heptane over it. And I know what happens with an unsupported nickel-copper alloy. In other words, I know what happens when nickel's interacting with copper. So when I pass the heptane over this thing, if they're not alloying, it ought to behave just like nickel, because copper's dead by comparison. Remember what I said? The non-transition metals are inactive catalysts by comparison to group A metal. Well, when I passed the stuff over the supported material, I found indeed the stuff was inhibited, just like happened on the unsupported alloy. That told me right away I had to have the nickel and copper interacting on this support. So I used that philosophy to look at lots of catalysts and developed a whole, science of bimetallic clusters based purely on chemical probes. I didn't know anything about structural parameters like the distance in a crystallite of that size, whether it was going to be any different from what it was in a big nickel copper crystal. I didn't have any idea about the exact coordination number of nickel to copper, but I did know from the chemical probe that I had nickel copper interaction or platinum iridium interaction or platinum copper or palladium gold, what have you. I looked at all kinds of systems, and that was very important. So then I also found another interesting thing, which also was a very important scientific, a second very important scientific finding, that you could prepare a highly dispersed alloy on a support, and showed that purely by chemical probes. So I'd say that's a second important scientific finding. A third thing which came into this, in the course of exploring lots of these systems, I found interesting catalytic effects even for systems which ordinarily would not make an alloy. I could take two metals which were completely immiscible in the bulk. A good example is ruthenium and copper. Yeah. Ruthenium is a hexagonal close-packed metal. Copper is a face-centered cubic metal. And in the bulk, they are effectively completely immiscible. The solubility is very low. But nevertheless, when I made catalysts with ruthenium and copper, I found these same kind of inhibiting effects for the hydrogenolysis reaction that I found for an alloy where you could form a complete solid solution. So what the heck is going on? If they don't alloy, how can they be interacting? Okay, so then how can that be happening? So I thought, is it possible that one component could be covering the surface of the other component? Even though they don't mix in the solid to form a homogeneous solid solution, could one of them be forming a layer on top of the other? In other words, could copper maybe be coating the surface of nickel, or copper coating the surface of ruthenium, I should say, for the immiscible pair? And I would visualize that much like the adsorption of a gas. Hydrogen adsorbs on platinum, or hydrogen adsorbs on ruthenium. But now, instead of hydrogen adsorbing on ruthenium, I'd be talking about copper adsorbing on ruthenium. Okay, well, if that's what's happening, we ought to be able to get at this pretty nicely by measuring adsorption. We pick a gas like hydrogen, which adsorbs on ruthenium but doesn't adsorb on copper. And if indeed the copper is covering the surface of ruthenium, we ought to be able to see inhibition of hydrogen adsorption. That's exactly what happened. So And then later on, a tool like electron spectroscopy came along, which is a surface active tool, and we could confirm that indeed the copper was converting, covering the surface of the ruthenium. So you have a situation here. If I had a real big ruthenium crystal, then I'd have a little bit of copper on the outside. I would have an entity where I would have only a very little amount of copper in this, because you'd have a big core of ruthenium and a little bit of copper on the outside. But suppose I make this crystallite smaller and smaller, which is what you're doing when you have a supported system. Eventually, you get to a point where the ruthenium core is so small that the amount of copper on the outside is comparable to the amount of ruthenium on the inside. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So, and you could make that quantitative. We actually did adsorption experiments to show that. So that made a very important point, that said when you had a very highly dispersed system, you could have a stoichiometry that you could not achieve in a bulk. You have the stoichiometry simply because of the state of dispersion of the material. In other words, how small it is. In other words, if that ruthenium is small enough, that core, the amount of copper that it takes to cover that core is comparable to the amount of ruthenium inside. So when it's that small, I have an entity where I can achieve a stoichiometry solely based on the size of the entity. So I said I need a new terminology now other than alloys, because obviously these are two materials that don't form an alloy in the bulk. And if I'm going to go to the patent office and try to get a patent, I'm not going to talk about a supported alloy catalyst of two components which don't form alloys. So I needed a new term, and I called them bimetallic clusters. That's where that came in. That's the reason for it, was that I needed to, because to call these alloys would be misleading, because they don't form alloys in the bulk. It's simply a situation where one component selectively goes to the surface of the other. And effectively what you're forming is a copper-ruthenium bond at the surface. Later on, as inorganic chemistry develops, some of the inorganic chemists today are making mixed transition metal cluster compounds which have features like this. Okay, so that was the other important scientific point, that that bimetallic catalysts need not be restricted to components which are totally miscible in the bulk. If you did that, you would have a needless restriction which would needlessly limit you in the number of systems that would be of interest. Geez, I hope I haven't gone on too long.
No, it's excellent. Perfect. It's exactly the kind of description I'm looking for. Because you anticipate all of my questions right down the line, so I just sat and listened. In 72, you had a paper on which became a citation classic.
That's a nickel-copper paper. That was some of the work that I mentioned earlier. We didn't report that work immediately after the work was done. As one thing you know in industry, there's usually a lag between the time that you first do the experimental work and you publish it. The work was done in the 60s, but we published it in 1972. And that was a basic paper in which you revealed this strong selectivity factor in catalysis by alloys, where reactions that involve carbon-carbon rupture were very different from reactions that involve, say, purely dehydrogenation or hydrogenation type reactions, that there was this very important selectivity factor involved. Also, it tended to reinforce the idea that you could have surface segregation of one of the components in a metal alloy. But the most important feature of that paper was the selectivity. In other words, that reactions that involve rupture of carbon-carbon bonds behave very different on these alloys from, say, reactions that involve purely activation of carbon-hydrogen bonds. So you see you have something very basic to chemistry there. You're talking about a basic difference in the way the alloy treats carbon-carbon versus carbon-hydrogen bonds. And that's very important in our business.
It's almost like you can dial in what you want, isn't it?
Well, you're starting, yeah. Maybe we're not quite there with some of the enzyme catalysts, chemists and their tailor-making of all these enzymes and enzyme analogs and so on, but that's the idea, yeah.
The term that you coined, bimetallic clusters,
yeah.
How readily was that accepted?
Well, I didn't have too much trouble, but you could see a reason why there might be a problem there, because the word cluster, at about the time I used it for that, inorganic chemists were talking about clusters, but they were talking about clusters of metal atoms within a molecule. In other words, a transition metal cluster compound, like a carbonyl. So you could maybe have something like ruthenium, where you will have ruthenium-ruthenium bonding with a lot of carbon monoxide ligands around the thing. And they call this a cluster. But it's a cluster within a transition metal compound. I'm basically here talking about essentially a naked cluster, in a sense that there's no ligands around that, at least until you start doing catalysis on it or start adsorbing molecules on it. But once you start adsorbing molecules on it, you may have something very much like their transition metal cluster compound. Well, so the word cluster has been in chemistry for a while before me, but the inorganic chemists did not have exclusive claim to that either. They used it in that sense. People interested in statistical mechanics and in phenomena of condensation of vapors to liquids had talked about clusters. You can see this throughout their literature. And they talk about clusters being anything from a few molecules to something the size of a liquid drop, which is going to have 10 to the 22 molecules or something like that. Well, there was some feeling that people didn't like my bringing up the term bimetallic cluster without specifying the size. As a matter of fact, in some of the first papers where I introduced this terminology, and people were objecting, they said, cluster's got to be pretty small, because they're thinking in terms of the cluster that the inorganic chemist was thinking of. Okay, well, that certainly applied to a lot of our catalysts, too. The clusters are small. But I did not want to get sucked into the idea that we should limit them to size, because I wasn't sure. I thought that was pretty arbitrary. And I used arguments like the statistical mechanics usage of the word cluster. And I'm very happy I did that without getting too specific about, in other words, it might be anywhere from a few atoms up to hundreds and maybe thousands of atoms. It now turns out the inorganic chemists themselves are synthesizing some of these cluster compounds. One of the last ones I heard had 512 gold atoms in it. This is in a compound with a bunch of ligands around it. So now you're not talking about a few atoms. So for a little while, maybe there was some people could not see my using, because in some of my work, I would talk about crystallites as large as 50 or 100 angstroms being, I would even call those clusters, and I don't think they liked it. But I can see now that they're seeing that this is coming very much coming together. I mean, people are synthesizing these giant molecules with these clusters in them, and I think that I think I had every right to use the cluster terminology in a broader sense. But I needed a terminology. I think it's a good terminology for this, because what we're saying in a bimetallic cluster, that's not too specific. In other words, it doesn't say that you have to have a homogeneous solid solution, that it includes that. But if you have a situation where one component tends to concentrate at the surface on another one, even though they don't form an alloy, that's still reasonable to call that a bimetallic cluster. In other words, I thought it was broad enough language that it's not misleading and still pretty much all-inclusive of the kinds of systems which are of interest. And I said there was the practical issue, which I will be the first to admit, that I wondered about dealing with the patent office. I didn't want to go in there. In a case of nickel-copper, there's no problem. You say, okay, so you're claiming a nickel-copper alloy on a support for this, so fine. But if I go in there with ruthenium-copper and he has a phase diagram in front of him for the bulk solid system and he says, these don't alloy, you're out of your head. So, you can go into all kind of explanations then, but, you know, it's sort of like trying to reverse a bad initial impression. It'd be better to have a language which was consistent with what you're trying to convey. And I thought that bimetallic cluster was I thought it was better to talk about bimetallic cluster, which would then include highly dispersed alloys as well as systems which didn't ordinarily form alloys.
You worked with different metal combinations, but it was the platinum iridium one.
Now that, that was the one that came on as a commercial catalyst. Yeah. Now the two types of systems I emphasized mainly were combinations of group 8 with 1B, as I've already mentioned. That's things like nickel copper, palladium gold, ruthenium copper, and so on. Another type of system that I worked on very broadly also was combinations of two group 8 metals, like, say, platinum and palladium, platinum and iridium, platinum ruthenium, palladium iridium, combinations of that type. You might have asked, why did I restrict myself to those combinations of metals? In other words, only consider group 8 with 1B or two components within group 8. I also did some work on two components within group 1B, like, say, a gold-copper system or a gold-silver system. I did some work on that in the area of oxidation. But well, the main reason for sticking to those metals is that they are metals which have a fighting chance of being metals under the conditions of catalysis. In other words, usually in a practical catalyst, to get high surface areas, you disperse it on a support, like I've mentioned before. And when you do this, the group 8 or group 1B metals are about the only metals that you can reduce to the metallic form on the support. If you took molybdenum, you're going to wind up with an oxide. You're going to have a hard time ever reducing molybdena to metallic molybdena on alumina and keeping it that way. Or tungsten or something of that sort. One metal that I think you can get reduced that's not in group 8 is rhenium. You can get rhenium reduced on top of a support, and that was an issue which was hotly debated at one time, but I think it's pretty clear that you can get rhenium reduced down to the metallic form on the support. But that's the main reason I stuck with the group 8, group 1B systems, because these are this, for all practical purposes, catalysis by metals is pretty much catalysis by the group 8 and group 1B metals, for all practical purposes. Okay, now in looking at two combinations within two metals within group 8, we already know platinum is a good catalyst in reforming from the early days of Vladimir Hensel and so on. We knew that iridium had properties very much like platinum. It's right next door to platinum in the periodic table. With this difference, iridium tends to have a very much higher activity to break carbon-carbon bonds than does platinum. Even though iridium will catalyze the aromatization of a molecule like normal heptane to toluene pretty effectively, it has a pretty high ability to crack carbon-carbon bonds also. So then you might say, well, why the heck do you want a metal like this in a reforming catalyst? You're going to just butcher your feed down to low molecular weight hydrocarbons. Well, it's not quite the way it works out. It turns out that when the platinum and iridium get together in the form of a bimetallic cluster, that the platinum tends to moderate the hydrogenolysis activity of the iridium. And it turns out that a platinum-iridium bimetallic cluster will give a product distribution not very different from platinum, the distribution of the various products, but will give it to you at a much higher rate. So in other words, I can, if I were building a reactor, I could build the reactor a lot smaller with a platinum-iridium catalyst. In other words, use much less catalyst because it's a good deal more active. However, one important feature, in addition to the higher activity, is that the platinum-iridium catalyst forms coke less readily than a platinum catalyst. Over a period of time, it makes less coke than platinum, so it deactivates less rapidly. You will run it for a longer period of time before you have to regenerate the catalyst. So it turns out that you get an activity advantage as well as a as an activity maintenance advantage, enormous advantage over catalyst, over a platinum catalyst. And so that was very important at the time the catalyst was introduced. We actually first applied it commercially in 1971. And if you will remember, this was in the early days of people becoming interested in lead-free gasoline. And when you take lead out of gasoline, if you want to maintain the quality of the gasoline, you have to have some other high anti-knock components to put in there. That means you need more aromatic hydrocarbons. That means you need to have a greater rate of production of aromatic hydrocarbons. So higher activity catalysts and so on were very exciting at the time of the first, when we were first interested in lead-free gasoline. And so it turned out that the platinum-iridium catalyst, as I said, had the high activity and the high activity maintenance, and so we went on and commercialized that catalyst. At about the same time, we had a competitor interested in a different type of bimetallic catalyst, a platinum-rhenium catalyst. This was the Chevron company. They have a man named Klukstahl, whom I may have met him, but I'm not sure. I don't know him well.